Okay, welcome to Waynesville. Pretty on, Garth.
Pretty on, Wayne.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll.
We're not worthy. We're not worthy. We're not worthy.
Actually, I think I'm the one not worthy, because today Wayne's World director Penelope Spheeris is on the show. She's also the genius behind the decline of the Western Civilization movies, parts 1, 2, and 3. You know how much I love part 3. Actually, part 2 is what I love, and all you long-time Talk is Jericho listeners know that. Part 2 was The Metal Years, one of my all-time favorite documentaries, with my all-time favorite Paul Stanley quote included in that. We're going to talk about that film, but we're going to hear a lot of great stories about what it was like making Wayne's World with Mike Myers and Talk is Jericho alumni Dana Carvey. The movie's celebrating its 25th birthday. Hard to believe it's 25 years old already. And there's a brand new special edition re-release of the movie on DVD and digital download. It's got new bonus features, new commentary track, and 10 lucky sexy beast Talk is Jericho listeners are going to win a free digital download of Wayne's World 25. I'm going to tell you exactly how you can win coming up a little later on the show, but we're going to get to Penelope Spheeris.
I'd have to say, a sphincter says what?
What?
A sphincter says what?
What?
Exactly.
So I'm really excited today. Penelope Spheeris is here. And first of all, when I first started following your movies, I thought you pronounced your name Penelope.
Oh, yeah, it sort of rhymes with cantaloupe. No, it's Penelope.
But I never knew that. Like, you were the first Penelope I ever saw.
Oh wow!
Like on a marquee or whatever. So I was like Penelope
yeah.
Spheeris. So,
well, now that Penelope Cruz has come into
right.
the world, then everybody can say my name. Now.
She's made it like hip again.
She made it cool
to be Penelope.
Exactly.
Did people call you Penelope when you were a kid?
No.
Okay,
no.
It was always Penelope.
Yeah, it was Penelope.
I'm just the idiot that didn't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah, well, it's okay. You're a cute idiot.
Oh, thank you. But it's exciting, though, because a lot of stuff to talk about, but obviously the thing that's right off the top of our heads is the Wayne's World 25th anniversary, which and we talked briefly about this kind of alternate universe, very light, funny movie that's it's an American classic. And did you ever think that when you were doing this?
No, actually, Chris, it was the fact that it did well when it was released in 92 was a shock.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. I feel very blessed and very happy, and I can't believe it.
It's the eternal question, you know, like asking an author, where do you get the ideas for your stories? But what do you think it is about this movie that resonates 25 years later?
I think it's probably the fact that times are a little tougher now and daily life is a little more stringent and people don't have quite as much fun. And I think people like to go back and experience what it's like to be 20 years old and have that youthful, joyous thing going on, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So. It's interesting, though, because you talk about it's coming from a Saturday Night Live sketch, Wayne's World, which, you know, notoriously, and I think Wayne's World might have been one of the first Saturday Night Live movies, per se.
Yeah, it was this, only one before us was the Blues Brothers.
Blues Brothers,
but
right.
I don't mean to be bragging, but we did better business.
Oh.
But they were, you know, Blues Brothers was cool.
It's a pretty good movie. So
yeah.
I think those probably could be the best two SNL movies ever. Because then this pantheon that followed of like these sketches that are 90 seconds, 4 minutes, 3 minutes that probably should have stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
With Wayne's World, I mean, it really was a 90-minute story, but it didn't feel like it was perfect. It didn't feel like, oh, this is stretching.
Right. Yeah,
you know
that's
what
the studio was worried about when we started working on it was, how are you going to turn a 5-minute piece into 90 minutes, you know? But I was never worried about it because the writers, Bonnie and Terry Turner and Mike Myers, did such a great job on the first pass of the script, and they just kept working on it all the 34 days that I shot, you know?
There was, 34 days?
Yeah.
It's like a guerrilla filmmaking, right?
Huh?
It's a guerrilla filmmaking.
It was
so quick.
Yeah, and back in those days, it was average studio movie cost $63 million, and Paramount gave us $14 million, and they never thought it would do $200 million in business.
Right off the bat, too, just a huge hit as it was, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think because the characters are so lovable. That's a good one reason.
Yeah, and there's also, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, and this is what Bonnie and Terry always tried to do, which was to be ahead of the audience, to make it so that it wasn't predictable, you know? And if the audience thought it was going to go one direction, then make a left turn and then surprise people, you know?
Right.
And then we broke the third and fourth wall and whatever else walls there were to break. And, you know, Mike's talking to the camera. We just did unconventional things.
So, for example, when you're breaking the third and fourth wall, was that something that was in the script? Was that something that you worked on with Mike? Or how do you approach that as a director?
It was a question that we had to, you know, deal with and handle very carefully because it's not something that's done very often in films.
Right.
You know, and we were a little bit nervous to do it, but Mike was so good at talking to the camera and like pulling you into his private little world that we could see it was working. So,
you know, it reminded me of if you ever watched Three's Company when Mr. Roper would look at the camera like, you know, Tinkerbell, and he would do it in a way where he's like, you know, I'm in this, we're in this together. Hello. Kind of did the same thing with Mike.
That's
Wayne,
funny.
You know,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do you approach this? Like I said, when you said the script is great, it turns out good, but you still have to keep this movie rolling for a 90-minute period based on a 5-minute sketch with all these wonky things that are happening within this world of Wayne. Mm-hmm. How did you approach that as a director?
Well, you know, when you're writing a script, if new pages come in, you have different colors so that you can integrate it into your original white copy. Mm-hmm. And there are about 10 colors that are used, like weird colors like persimmon and aqua and stuff like that, colors like that, meadowlark, I don't know what it is, but anyway, we went through all 10 colors 3 times. That's how many new pages came in all the time.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, and it was my job to keep track of, just to make sure that whatever new stuff fit with what we already shot, you know, and luckily I have that kind of brain where I remember what's going to fit together, and if something came in and it didn't match with what we already shot, I knew to throw it out. You know,
You know, another thing I liked about it, too, was, you know, you're especially talking about a movie based around heavy metal, for example, hard rock. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's a tendency to make it kind of dumb it down and make these guys stupid. And obviously they were just dudes, but it was never stupid. It was very respectful towards music and towards rock and roll.
Good.
Which was a pretty, kind of a rare thing in a movie like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you know or not, but back in the day when Harry Shearer and Chris Guest were putting together Spinal Tap, they came to me through a mutual friend called David Jablin, and they gave me their treatment for Spinal Tap. And I looked at it, and I'm like, you know what, you guys, I don't want to make fun of heavy metal music. I love it too much. I'm not going to make fun of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, they went and got Rob Reiner to direct it, and he did a fabulous job, and I kicked myself in the
wow.
butt. To this day.
You had the chance to direct Spinal Tap.
I did. But, you know, I was looking at the guys, and they didn't look heavy metal, and they didn't look like they understood it, and I didn't want to make fun of the music. So I dumbed out on that one.
Interesting. So let me ask you this. Why were they coming to you to direct this, and why did you get the Wayne's World gig? Had you worked
with
those guys?
Well, I was working on Decline Part 2, and I was sort of known around town for... I had the first music video company in Los Angeles.
Okay.
It was called Rock and Reel, and I did music videos way before there was an EMTV.
Hmm.
And, you know, I had done the first Decline, and I was actually going to look up the timing between Spinal Tap and the second Decline, because it was right around the same time.
Spinal Tap came out probably 2 or 3 years earlier.
Yeah.
I think Spinal Tap was 84 and Decline was 88, right? Or 87?
You are such the trivia dude.
Big time, yeah.
I'm a
movie buff for certain types of movies.
I love it.
I'm a rock guy, so any rock movie, I'll tell you.
Right, right. Well, anyway, yeah, I did blow that one with
with
Spinal Tap, but I did make up for it a little bit with Decline Part 2.
But how are they coming to you? Like, how does Harry Shearer know to come to Penelope Spheres?
Because I was working with his partner, Albert Brooks, and I knew Harry was writing with Albert, and I produced all the Saturday Night Live shorts that Albert directed.
Gotcha. Those little 90-second vignettes, black and white or whatever they may be.
Yeah. Lorne called me up, and because I knew Lorne Horn before he even started Saturday Night Live, and he goes, "I found this really funny guy, but he doesn't know how to make movies, Penelope, and you know how to do it, so please show him how to do it, would you?" And
that's Lauren. Yeah,
everybody loves to make fun of the way Lauren talks. He's so cute. But so yeah, I taught Albert how to shoot, and he taught me how to deal with Hollywood, and taught me a lot about comedy, and it was a good relationship. And Harry was a co-writer with Albert on a lot of the shows.
Okay, gotcha.
And then Harry brought me over to meet with Chris and, you know, the other people involved.
Sure.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about working with those guys, and you have obviously the sketch comedy background, you're understanding kind of what the vibe of it is. I'm sure that kind of helped with Wayne's World as well, knowing like you have this, it's comedy, but it's smart comedy, it's intelligent.
That's right. Well, that's the thing is we always did try to make it really smart. And like I said, stay ahead of the audience, you know. I mean, it talks down to the audience if it's stupid comedy, you know, and you have to respect the audience because basically they are smarter than us. I'm sorry, but that's just, you have to respect that, you know. That's what I think anyway.
Well, there's so many catchphrases from Wayne's World that still, you know, last to this day, you know, like squeeze me, baking powder, like shwing and all that sort of stuff. When, like I said, when you watch the movie back, it still holds up. It's not like an early 90s time capsule. Dudes talk like that to this day almost in a way.
I know. I heard right when the film came out and did well here in the United States domestically, the studio said, "Well, Penelope, you know, you're very lucky that it did this well, but we're going to release it internationally now, but they're never going to get it over there anywhere because they don't understand what schwing means. They don't understand what fished in means. They don't understand that stuff." So evidently, Paramount, I'd love to get one of these, Paramount made up a little booklet that was like for each country translations.
Oh.
I know. So I don't know what schwing is in Japanese, but maybe it's a picture. I don't know.
Right. We don't know, right?
We don't know. But it worked because it did well internationally too, you know.
Well, and that like once again, that resonates with I'm assuming the fan base was probably people my age at the time, early 20s, early teens.
Yeah.
So you can kind of lock onto those catchphrases.
Well, what happened, I think, was our target audience was early 20s, your age at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it hit there. And then the younger generation wanted to know what their older brothers and sisters were looking at and were so happy about. So they started going. So we started getting the tweens and the early teens. And then after that, the parents of both of those kids wanted to see it to find out what's going on. So we had three generations jumping on board. And I think that's what, you know, pulled it together.
Yeah, it was a multi-generational, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit. I've had Dana Carvey on this show before. Super funny, obviously, as you know. Was it mostly sticking to the script, or was there a lot of improv moments that you caught on camera as well? It seems like Dana's a little bit of a firecracker when it comes to that sort of thing.
He totally is, yeah. And he's really, really funny.
Yeah.
There was a mix, actually. We shot the script to the best that we could, you know, like sometimes Dana wanted to shoot it one way and then Mike wanted to shoot it another way. So I'd do that and then I'd shoot it my way. And then they go, "Well, can we just like, you know, improv one here?" And I'm like, "Heck yeah, go ahead." And that scene on the car when they're lying there looking up at the
airport or the planes?
At the plane.
"She's a fox. In France, she would be called La Renard and she would be hunted with only her cunning to protect her.
She's a babe.
She's a robo-babe. In Latin, she would be called Babia Majora.
If she were a president, she'd be Babraham Lincoln. Did you ever find Bugs Bunny attractive when he'd put on a dress and play a girl bunny?"
"No." "No. Okay. Keep looking up."
"Okay."
We actually shot that on a soundstage, and it was the last day of the shoot, and all the guys, everybody was just so tired, and there was a limo waiting outside the stage, and I didn't even have time to turn the camera on and off. I just had to let it run, and they improvised really a lot right there. That whole thing about, like, if Bugs Bunny was wearing a dress or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Would you be attracted to the girl Bugs Bunny?
Yeah. And, you know, all that stuff was improvised right there, and I think it worked really good because they were so tired, and they just started busting out laughing, and that was real laughter. They weren't faking that laugh, you know?
Well, like you said, on a 30 to 40 day shoot, I'm sure you had to
they were toast.
Film as much as you could, right?
They were totally toast, and so was
so
I.
So were you.
Yeah. I'm just like, oh, and then I look out the stage door, and the limo's sitting there, and Garth yanks his wig off, throws it back in the stage, and runs in and jumps in the car. And they went back to Saturday Night Live to write. That's how close we came.
Oh, you mean they went straight from the set to New
to
York?
Airport to go to write on Saturday Night Live.
Well, that's right, because they were still on SNL at the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, and Lorne was saying, you got to get that thing done. I need these guys back here. You got to get that thing done. I'm like, I'm trying, man.
So they bring you on to be the director, and you mentioned a couple times Mike's vision, and obviously, you know, Wayne's World is basically Mike Myers' creation, the way he sees it. Did you have, did you ever have to, it's almost like being the coach of the LA Kings when Wayne Gretzky's playing. How do you coach Wayne Gretzky, right?
Yeah.
How are you directing Mike Myers, or is he directing you on how to direct
him?
Well,
see, I had one, Mike had a lot up on me because he knew that character better than anybody. Mm-hmm. Okay, so whatever character stuff or choices about wardrobe for the character, I let him go with it, you know. But I had one up on him because Wayne's World was my seventh movie, and it was Mike's first movie.
Oh, wow. Okay. That was his first movie.
Yeah, dude, it was like we had to teach him how to hit his mark, you know.
Gotcha.
He knew a little bit from the show, but I mean, the show, he sits down all the time. He didn't have to hit no mark, you know.
Yeah. And plus, that's a live show. A movie, you've got to film it this way and take it from the right and the left and up and
ball
down.
Game. Yeah, whole different thing, you know. And then the other trip was that, that we had that pacer, and I didn't think, you know, like, can he drive? I didn't think that. But I asked him to sit in the pacer because I want to see, like, frame up the camera and see how the windshield looked and all that stuff.
Talking about for the Bohemian Rhapsody scene or just in general?
He had to drive that car in the film, you know, various places.
Yeah.
And he told me he didn't know how to drive.
Really?
Because he's from Toronto and he was always taking public transpo.
And living in New York, and right? Taxis.
Same deal. Yeah. And he didn't know how to drive. So he makes a joke about how, you know, we didn't have much money, so we had to give him Sears driving lessons. And he said he would be staying at the, I don't know how he's getting a room at the Four Seasons, but he would be at the Four Seasons, and the guy, the concierge, would come up and go, "Sir, your car is here." And he would go out, and it would be like Sears driving school.
Because don't they even make a joke about that, where it's like, you know, in Hollywood, when guys are driving, they're not even paying attention to the road, and they're looking all over the place because it's on the back of a truck. They actually kind of incorporated that into the film, right?
Oh, right. You're right.
Yeah,
one of those kind of breaking the wall.
Yeah, breaking the wall. Yeah. And then also, too, like with the product placement.
Yeah, and the Grey Poupon.
Grey Poupon is another one that I'm not even sure I know even what Grey Poupon is or if I've ever really seen it.
It's a mustard.
Sure.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Do you have any Grey Poupon?
But here's the thing. I did the Little Rascals after I did Wayne's World, and the studio called and asked if I would cast Donald Trump as Waldo's dad. And I'm like, well, he's a rich guy from New York. Sure, why not? This is 96, right?
Right.
So, like, I just kick myself to this day that I didn't get Donald to play the guy driving in the Grey Poupon Bentley.
It could have been him.
I know, right?
Foreshadowing, right?
Darn!
Game on!
Yeah, game on!
But let's talk about some other people that were in the movie. I think Rob Lowe, at this point in time, he's a super funny guy. He's in a lot of comedy stuff.
Yeah.
I think Wayne's World might have been his first comedic performance.
You're good, Chris.
Right?
You are good. As a matter of fact, Rob gives Wayne's World credit for teaching him his comedy chops, you know? Mm. He claims he was mostly a kind of romantic comedy type dude before that, and that is very different than, you know, flat-out comedy
like we were doing
in Wayne's World. So he does give a lot of credit, but, you know, it was Lorne's idea to cast Rob.
Mm.
And he called me up and said, why don't we have for that Benjamin Oliver role, why don't we have, Rob Lowe? And I said, I don't think that's a good idea because he just had some really bad publicity, you know.
It was like a sex tape or something.
It was some kind of, video, and it was not...
Back when that was controversial.
Yeah, it was not that good, and, you know.
Right.
And so Lauren says, well, that's okay. We can get him cheap.
Always the number one...
And that's what happened.
Oh, okay.
You know, and we got a good deal.
So when you brought him in, and he's and you're, was he like saying like, hey, I'm not sure about comedy. Are you gonna have to help me out?
No, because he's an actor, and you'd never cop to that.
Okay, gotcha.
You would have to, you know, just kind of like, but see, he picked it up fast, you know, because being around Mike and Dana is hilarious in the first place. Okay, and he knew that he was the bad guy, and he was sort of like the butt of a lot of jokes and everything, and he took it really well, you know. Like one of my favorite scenes in Wayne's World is when the cop pulls him over and takes out that glove, you know. and then Rob, it was his idea to walk funny afterwards, like it hurt, you know.
Right.
That was his idea.
Yeah. and you're talking also too about there's a couple iconic scenes that pop in my mind. One is obviously the Bohemian Rhapsody scene. Tell us about that, about the idea behind it. How did you frame it? How did you shoot it?
Well, that was the one song in the film that was there from the very beginning, and it was the one song that Mike insisted stay there. And I was fine with it. I mean, I always loved Queen. When I first envisioned it in the film, I was like, what do I do with this? And then I thought of putting it as a title sequence. And then when we went down to shoot, we shot out in a suburb called Covina, and we went down to shoot, we were all night long, and I had to move the camera. We were towing the Pacer. I had to move the camera to various positions, and so they were actually headbanging for 4.5 or so hours.
That's hard to do.
Totally, I know.
That's
like,
hard
it's hard to do with a 3-minute song, but I think Rhapsody's like 7 or 8 minutes,
yes.
Whatever, 9, I don't know.
Right, divided into 4 hours.
Times 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like Mike was getting mad, and he's like, give me some Advil, and this isn't funny, and why are we doing this? I don't like it, man. And I'm like, just do it, please. He goes, well, it hurts. And he's like, today he still says, my neck still hurts from doing
from that.
I'm like, yeah, but look at all the people you made laugh, man.
And also, too, we're talking about Queen right now in 2017, but in 1992, not the most popular of bands.
No.
I think Freddie Mercury just passed away.
That's right.
So they're kind of like the 70s animal.
Right.
And that put them like back on the map.
Big
really
time.
Did.
Big
I think
time.
Bohemian even went back in the charts and that sort of thing.
Brian May always says thanks. You know? Yeah, everything. Yeah. I had gone to a party on the Queen Mary for Queen. I think it was MCA or one of the labels that was having, and Freddie wasn't there. And that's when we knew he was sick. But when I did the video for Wayne's World of Bohemian Rhapsody, I had to look at every single piece of tape or film, whatever that was shot with him. And man, I fell in love with that guy. He is amazing, you know.
With Freddie?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
He was an incredible person, an amazing songwriter, and so
maybe the best frontman of all time.
I think so.
You know, I mean, he's up there, top three.
Yeah.
He might go a different direction here or there, but he's got to be up there.
I agree.
If you watch the Live Aid Queen set, it's about 20 minutes long, and it's probably the best live gig of all time.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's so good. Just he commands the crowd, and he's just that presence and that, you know. And
intense.
Then obviously the riffs and the songs behind them. But just
amazing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he brought opera into rock and roll.
Well, yeah, completely, completely. Did you, I mean, and I know what you're going to say to this, but when you're filming that scene, do you know it's something special, or is it just another scene in a 34-day shoot that's just going to go in there?
B. No, we didn't know it was that special.
Yeah, and it's like I said, an iconic scene. It's up there.
Well,
with...
check this out. Aurora, Illinois, which is where Wayne's World was theoretically set, starts a celebration now because the film is being re-released. And this is February, and it's going to go on until July the 4th, where they're going to that's 6 months, man. It was like celebrating for six months.
Six months.
And they're going to have a trying to get into the Guinness Book of World Records with the most people headbanging to Bohemian Rhapsody at the same time. I know.
Okay, yeah. Well, hey, that's what else has Aurora got going on?
I got in trouble, really, because I said, and I probably shouldn't repeat it, but I said, well, that's what I said. I said, well, don't they have any pumpkins or strawberries to celebrate? And then they got mad at me and said, what's the matter? She thinks pumpkins are more important than her movie.
Yeah, we got good pumpkins.
Yeah, I don't want to get in a fight with Aurora.
Yeah, okay, fine. We love you, Aurora. Shout out to all the fine people in Aurora.
Yes.
Farley, I think one of his first films, he was in there. Was that as a favor to Myers, or did he have to audition?
No, it was Lorne again.
Lorne put
him
in there?
Lorne called me and said, I won't do the accent. Okay, I'm sorry. I've got this guy. And he's really, really funny, and people love him, but he's very shy.
Really?
And, yeah, and he is afraid of the camera. And so he said, I want you to get him used to being in front of a camera. He does it on the show, but he's really uncomfortable. Come on, put him in front in the movie. So we gave him a little part in the back of the venue where Alice played.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was like the bouncer that says which way to go. And he kind of made it his own. He started to, you know, like point weird and everything. And he was funny, even though he hardly had any lines. And then I work with Chris again on Black Sheep at Paramount.
So 3 or 4 years later, five years later.
Him and Spade.
Yeah. Still legitimately funny.
Oh, yeah.
Much more used to the camera, obviously, at that point.
Oh, yeah. He was, like, real comfy there.
Yeah. Do you have any good stories and memories about him?
Well, the thing about Chris was, I mean, you've heard about Tom Cruise and people like that wanting to do their own stunts. Well, that was Farley. Farley would only, you know, we'd always have this this stuntman standing around that looked just like him and doing nothing all day because Chris wouldn't let him do his stunts, you know? I mean, one day he was supposed to hit his head on a tree branch, and I told him, I said, Chris, don't, man. You just don't. And he hit himself so hard, he went down, and we're like, are you there? Are you there? Please come back. And he was okay, but it was a bad hit. And then the other thing that he really did was on that roll down the hill. Actually, it went viral lately because somebody posted that whole scene of Chris Farley falling down the hill. And it was like he was grabbing at branches and dirt and grass and everything. And the it said on the video, 2016. That's what people perceived.
Barely holding on.
Yeah, just barely. You know, anyway, but Chris did most of that as well.
Wow. He was involved in that. Because you could see a very physical comedian for sure.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't watch Beverly Hills Ninja until just lately. But yeah, you could see he's just like bouncing off the walls.
And getting bigger too, like towards he was getting 300 pounds, 350. Just one of those guys in the
long
list.
But he was still very physical.
Sure. John Candy, John Belushi, all these guys that are big, but they're still very physical, very graceful with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking back to that SNL skit with Patrick Swayze, the Chippendale dancer, I mean, that's totally funny.
Oh, my gosh,
right?
That was hilarious, wasn't it? I know.
Another, I love Meatloaf's quote of, who's playing tonight? The Shitty Beatles. Are they any good? No, they suck. So it's not just a catchy name.
Very good.
But once again, you had those guys sprinkled throughout. Meatloaf is in there.
Yeah.
You know, and then you mentioned Alice Cooper. That's another iconic scene that everyone knows with, like, you know, Milwaukee.
Oh, I know. I talked to Alice lately, and he said he was so shocked when he came to the set because he didn't know he was going to have 2 pages of dialogue. Okay. He thought he was just going to perform Feed My Frankenstein, walk off stage, thank you, bye, have the guys go, we're not worthy. But, of course, the writers say, oh, we got Alice Cooper coming down. Let's write 5 pages, you know? So they write that whole run about, Algonquin and Milwaukee and all that stuff. And we handed it to him. He was saying, I can't believe I had to learn that on the spot. But he did it, you know? And he spit it out, like, just perfectly, and people loved the scene
because it was great. Yeah,
so offhanded about it.
Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of Milwaukee is the fact that it's the only major American city to have ever elected 3 socialist mayors.
Does this guy know how to party or what?
Was he the original choice for that?
No. Did you know who was?
No.
Is that why you're asking?
Well, I heard something about it, but
it was Aerosmith. That's who. That's who Mike wanted to be in that scene. And they said that they didn't want to do it. I don't know why. Maybe they didn't get the script or whatever. I mean,
because they had done it on SNL. I remember they were actually in
Wayne's World. Yeah, he wanted.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so
they were on that
on SNL. Okay, well that makes sense then. Yeah, because Mike always likes to repeat everything that he does. That's true. Okay, but they wouldn't do it, and so that's when I went and got Alice because I had just worked with Alice on Decline Part 2.
Yes.
But then, on the second Wayne's World. Aerosmith did
They
perform.
Did show up.
Yeah, so they blew it twice. Thank you. I'm joking.
Dang.
I know. That's terrible.
Yeah, because you didn't direct the second Wayne's
That's
World.
Correct.
And it's not as good. It does not hold up.
I'm not gonna judge. I've never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I have. It doesn't hold up as good.
Well, thank
I'll
you.
I'll tell you.
But they're releasing the DVDs together, so people get to see them both now.
When you have such a huge hit movie, because Wayne's World, like you said, did $200 million.
Yeah.
Was that a Mike Myers call to not bring you back? Was it a studio thing, or was it just a personality
Well, this is a
issue?
Famous. This is a kind of really well known thing that happened that I actually they've told me to not talk about anymore.
Okay.
But I will anyway because nobody can tell me to shut up. Mike and I had a disagreement about the cut on the first Wayne's World.
About the cut?
Yeah, he had been out of town because his father unfortunately passed away, and he didn't get the privilege of seeing the test screening and how great the audience reacted.
Gotcha.
So when he got back, poor thing, he was in such a state of mind anyway, and then he wanted a bunch of cuts, so I wouldn't do it.
Out of curiosity, what did he want cut? Because the movie's very...
Well, he will admit to this day that there were certain things that he didn't think were funny.
Okay.
And so maybe those
certain
things, like,
whatever,
you know,
maybe.
When Laura hits the car,
On the bike?
Yeah.
He didn't think that was funny?
No.
It's pretty funny.
It's pretty funny.
I think it's funny,
pretty
yeah.
left field.
Hi,
Terminator
Wayne.
Cop and all that.
Hi. Boom. Right. Yeah. Yeah, she
But here's
great.
The thing. Mike, to me, is just as much of a genius comedian as anybody that you could think of. You know, I work with Richard Pryor. I work with so many of these really, really brilliant people. And I have so much respect for him. And it's fine that I didn't do. I mean, back then when I was told I couldn't do it, I mean, I had a nervous breakdown.
Sure, of course, right.
You know, or I should call it a nervous breakthrough. right?
Nervous breakthrough.
So I was a better person afterwards.
Yes.
So thank you.
But you mentioned, Allison, let's go to my favorite movie of yours, which is Decline of the Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. Once again, a movie that I saw, I think, when I was 15 or 16, however old I was when it came out. And it was hard to find. I grew up in Winnipeg, Canada.
Oh.
So there was kind of, I think it was on the pay-per-view channel up there.
Yeah.
Somebody recorded it. You got the VHS, you know, you kind of
Yeah, it's like an underground
it is.
Kind of thing that you passed around without
right.
your parents knowing.
Yes. And then it did come out on VHS cassette, and I lent it to my friend who a lot of my fans know, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and he never gave it back. So Austin still has my Metal Years VHS, which you could never find it up until I think a year ago, 2 years ago, when you finally released it along with 1 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
What a tremendous time capsule movie of the metal scene in the 80s, The Decline of the Western Civilization Part 2.
Yeah, well, thank you. It was a difficult thing all these years to to not put the DVDs out because people wanted them so badly.
Right.
You know, and finally my daughter, Anna Fox, came to me and said, Mom, you absolutely have to put these movies out. And I'm like, I don't like to look back. I mean, I haven't, you know how long it's been since I've seen Wayne's World? 1992.
Wow.
I haven't seen
25
it.
Years?
Yes.
Even now, you're not going to go check it out?
No.
Go sit in the back of the theater when they're showing it
Get
with dark glasses
yah-yahs
on?
Get my out and go,
yeah.
hey, I made that movie.
You should do it.
No.
No, that's not your thing?
I just kind of like to look forward, you know. But anyway, so we put the DVD set out, and it was hard because, you know, here's what happens. You look at it and you go, okay, yeah, now that part of my life is over, you know. And I just, you know, I just like to keep moving forward. And it's a little bit sad for me to look at it, you know.
To look back.
Yeah.
Even though to others it's a classic film that they watch you know, on a yearly basis.
I know, they really do, and I appreciate that they do it. And I'm so glad that I feel fortunate that I was able to capture those moments in time when, you know, not everybody had an iPhone back then, and so not everybody was shooting.
Right.
You know, and I was able to film and make some sense of it all. And
well, let's go through some of the movement. Mm-hmm. It's got, like, it's funny, because right off the bat, a quote that Paul Stanley said in that movie I've lived my life by. The only people that tell you can't make it are the ones that have failed. I'm not going to tell you can do it because I can do it. You know, you can do it. And Paul and I are actually friends now after all these years, and I've told him that. And it's just funny that that came when he's lying on a bed surrounded by five or six chicks in lingerie.
Yeah.
So what was your mindset? Like, there was a lot of famous people I kind of want to go through, but with Paul Stanley, were you thinking, like, you have to be in a bed with all these girls? Or was that his idea?
It was his idea.
It was his idea. That's great.
Yeah, be again. I asked Gene Simmons, where he wanted to be filmed. And he goes, well, I just don't want to do anything tacky. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, where do you want to be filmed? And he goes, how about trashy lingerie? I'm like, okay, Gene, we won't do anything tacky.
Let's go to the lingerie shop.
Let's just go and hang out in some underwear.
Yeah.
And then I asked Paul where he would like to be filmed, and he said, I want to be filmed in a bed with a bunch of beautiful women. I'm like, okay, well, we can work that. So he gets to the set the day that we're shooting, and he looks over in the corner, and we didn't have much money on that movie, so we couldn't afford, like, really beautiful women. We had some kind of pretty girls. And so Paul gets there and he goes, Penelope, come here. They're not pretty enough. I said, well, what am I going to do, man? We don't have, that's all we got. He goes, hold on a minute. He calls the Playboy Mansion, and we have to wait for a little while some beautifuler girls come down. So I know. So that's the girls in the bed there.
So you mentioned you don't have a lot of money for that shoot, but you had a lot of big stars in that. How did you get them?
You know, it was probably Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris and my daughter Anna, who worked in the office, that made the calls. And back then, it wasn't like today, where there's so many media outlets. And you know, back then, not everybody was shooting. There were not that many media outlets. And so if you approached, you know,
Aerosmith.
Yeah, or Lemmy from Motorhead or whatever, and you just go, hey, would you like to come down and do an interview? They say, yeah, you know. And speaking of Aerosmith, Chris, it was interesting because I was shocked that they were going to do it. I mean, it was like, okay, cool. And then we got the set all ready to go, and it was right after they were just all supposed to be cleaned up, you know, from their bad habits. And they sent these guys in to the set before Joe and Steven came in, and they took their hands and went around the cushions and the couch and all the shelves above and everything. I'm like, what are they doing? Making sure there was nothing stashed for them.
Wow.
I know. Yeah.
They were still that bad where...
Well, they were like the cops that came in to make sure that they weren't going to get loaded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they talk about that in the movie, Steven. Have you done drugs? A lot of drugs. All the drugs.
It went up my nose.
Well, yeah, I just smoked half of Peru up my nose.
God, you're good.
No, like I said,
I want your brain.
I've seen decline so many times. It's ridiculous.
Memorized.
And I love it, too, because you see, like, once again, the pomposity of Kiss, which they should have, lingerie shop. Bed of beautiful girls, and then you go talk to Lemmy, and it's just basically
standing against on a
hill with LA behind him, and some great quotes from Lemmy as well.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
in the dead of night.
Yeah, I wish I was beautiful.
Yeah, well, power to him. Yeah. So how was that with Lemmy? What time was that at? It looked like it was fairly late at night.
Dusk. You know, what happened was I was trying to imitate what I did with Brendan Mullen in The First Decline, you know.
Which was about punk.
And so we put Lemmy up at the same place that that I filmed Brendan. And it started out at dusk, but, you know, dusk doesn't last that long. And it's a beautiful time, and the lights are just starting to glimmer and everything. And then Lemmy was so great, we just kept going on until it was dark. Yeah. So.
And once again, there's such a great yin and yang in that movie, because the idea was to show the metal scene with the big stars like Motorhead and Aerosmith and Kiss, and then all the wannabe up-and-comers.
Well, that's the premise of the Decline of Western Civilization movies, is that I want to give support to the unknown bands, you know. It's like there's enough glory given to the big stars already.
Right.
You know, so let's show some new material here. So,
what were some of your favorite bands that you filmed? Was did any of them stick out of the kind of the younger ones?
In Decline 2?
In Decline 2, yeah.
Well, I mean, I love them all or they wouldn't be in there, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, if somebody plays Bathroom Wall by Faster Pussycat, mm-hmm. it'll be in my head for a week. You know, I love that song.
Yeah.
You know, and then, I mean, I love London. I love Odin. I love all those guys.
Both London came across really well in that, and Odin came across like very rock star kind of not quite understanding their place in life, whereas London did.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. Nader lives in Vegas now and he's still rocking.
Yeah. Lizzie Borden too.
Lizzie's still on the road actually.
Yeah, he is. Still, actually, I talked to him a couple months ago for the show. Yeah. We talked about Decline. How it was for them and all that sort of
That's
stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like I said, a great slice of what it was like at that time. Mm-hmm. Ozzy as well. Tell mm-hmm. us about Ozzy when you filmed with him.
How was it?
Yeah, tell us. Yeah.
It was
He's
fine.
Making breakfast.
Well,
basically.
In the first Decline, Darby Crash makes breakfast.
Uh-huh.
In the third Decline, Eyeball from the Resistance makes breakfast. In the second one, Ozzy. And Ozzy does not know how to cook, okay? And I don't think he would ever challenge that. And it's hilarious to watch him, too, because, like, he's putting butter in bacon and things like that, you know?
He's missing the glass when he pours the juice.
Well, I faked that.
Did you? Okay, I figured, yeah.
You know that,
yeah,
right?
It seemed like a great kind of cut in.
You know what else was faked, I hate to admit?
Tell us. I know what you're going to say. You're talking about the Chris Holmes?
Chris in the pool.
Okay, that's one of the famous scenes. Chris Holmes from Wasp, he's in the pool with his mom. He's drinking vodka right out of the bottle. He's super loaded, super drunk.
Yep.
Tell us the story.
Well, here's the thing. My daughter, who put the DVDs together, she's downstairs in the editing room, and she yells up, because I don't even want to look at this stuff, right? She yells up, Mom, you better come down here, because we got this whole scene with Chris, and he's putting water from the pool in the vodka bottle. Do you want people to know that? And I'm like, yeah, go ahead, because it's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started out with a half a bottle of vodka, and he did drink that, and then... You know, I did cut around the part where he was, you know, filling up the bottle with the pool water. But when he's pouring it on his head and everything, that's pool water.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he wasn't as drunk as he appeared to be?
No, he was blasted, dude.
What are you saying to his mom who's sitting there watching?
Well, you know what? Chris is from, like, a biker family, okay? So it's kind of, like, that's just what they did in life, you know? Sandy was a biker babe, you know?
Right.
I mean, they sit around, and they get tattoos, and they get loaded, and they, you know, fire up their bike, you know what I mean? What can I tell you? It was normal for her. You know.
When that movie came out, did it get a good, because once again, I don't know, was it in the theaters? Was it just a documentary?
It got a little bit of distribution, not very much, just a few theaters here and there. And then it came out on VHS, I think. But I have a history, Chris, except for Wayne's World and a couple of the big studio movies, of not getting my movies released. Like the first Decline never really got a release, you know. And The Boys Next Door
Great movie.
Thank you. And Suburbia never got a release, and this movie Dudes that I did with John Cryer and Flea never got a release.
Mm-hmm.
So now, in my older age here, not only do I have a 25-year celebration of Wayne's World, but I got the box set from the Decline movies, and now we're going to bring Dudes out, so I get to actually have the movies released. And, you know, I was so sad back in the day when they wouldn't get released and I would be crying, oh, my movies can't be seen, blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, well, that's kind of cool now that they're being seen.
Well, you know? Sure.
Yeah.
And there was a real kind of interesting period, like you mentioned, kind of early 80s California movies. You mentioned Suburbia, you mentioned Dudes, talking about Boys Next Door. And they're all very similar in tone, smaller budget, but not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And Boys Next Door, definitely one of those with Charlie Sheen and Max Caulfield, still one of my favorite movies of this day, and maybe Charlie's one of his first movies as well.
Yeah,
about these two kids who basically go on a weekend away from home and just end up as demented serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
Did you write the script on that? Or how did
no,
that come to you
know who wrote it was James Wong and Glenn Howe.
Hmm.
And those guys wrote also The X-Files.
Oh,
later.
James Wong. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's who wrote The Boys Next Door, and that's why, one reason why it was so great, you know?
Right.
And then... I mean, it was a very disturbing movie.
Disturbing. Good quote.
That's a word for
good
it,
description,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had to, I didn't understand because we had to send it back to, they're going to re-release it now, of course.
Oh, yeah. Like,
everything I did,
again,
they're re-releasing
you're
it.
Getting your due now.
Finally, finally. But we had to go back to the MPAA, Motion Picture Association, where they rate the movies 5 different times for the end scene. Where Patty Darbinville gets
thrown through the glass table, or which?
No, the one where she gets shaken.
Yeah, he shakes her to death, basically.
Yeah,
right?
I know, and it was like, there's not hardly any blood in the movie or anything, but I think it was just so disturbing on a psychological level that the MPAA, like, he shakes her, like, one time and her neck breaks. And I was like, it didn't even make any sense, you know?
But it was so violent because Charlie's having sex with her and then Max is the one who comes in and shakes her.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that is a disturbing scene.
It is, I know. So anyway, that movie's, I think, going to come out again, and I know Dudes is going to come out again, so.
Lots of stuff. A couple more people I want to talk to you about. I know that you worked with Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
You seem like you'd be the type of chick that gets along with her pretty well. You have similar vibes.
Well, thank you for saying that. And we did get along for a very, very long time. And what happened, the way I met Carrie was we had a mutual friend, Carol Caldwell. And it was back in the day when, you know, Albert and Monica and all the Belsons were, you know, the party animal comedic people were all hanging out together. And Carrie, you know, she had to go to rehab. And when she got out of rehab, she was shooting a movie, and I guess a movie got shut down. Mm-hmm. And so she couldn't get bonded after that. And so I asked her to be in my movie, and she goes, yeah, because then I could get bonded again, because I'll be a really good girl, I won't do any drugs, and then I can keep on acting. So they made, and the bond company said, Penelope, if you want Carrie in your movie, you have to sign a piece of paper that says if the film production gets shut down, that what it costs goes out of your salary.
Wow.
Yeah, but I did it, because I thought she was going to be fine, and she was, you know, and she did a great job. It was a stupidest movie in the world called Hollywood Vice Squad. And it was Robin Wright's first job when she was 19 years old.
Okay.
And I mean, it was a B movie, you know, like a kind of a, not Roger Corman, it was a guy named Sandy Howard, but it was a real a B movie type thing. And Carrie did a good job. And then after that, you know, I don't think she had a diagnosis at that point, the bipolar diagnosis. But if you know anybody that is bipolar, sometimes they're on the downside of the roller coaster, and they treat everybody bad because they're just like in that kind of a mood.
Right.
And I took it personally, you know, and so I said, okay, I'm not going to be friends anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But then I saw her a few times, you know, years later. I mean, I was at her house not too long before she passed away at a party she had, but very, very tragic situation there. And but if you guys have you seen that movie Bright Lights? That's about Debbie and.
It's a documentary that just came out. I haven't seen it yet.
So good.
Yeah.
Really says a lot.
Because they made that for release
before
they died.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is. I just cried all the way through it.
Well, that's the thing. You've been around the scene here for so long. You must see that happen from time
to time.
Well,
you know, the thing about that movie is it just shows you how rough this business is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was at the Directors Guild awards the other night, and there was a very, very well-known foreign actress sitting at the table, and she was talking to herself, you know, I'm not going to say her name, but she was talking to herself. And then I look over and she's got like lipstick smeared all over her face. I give her the mirror so she could fix her lipstick and everything. And she's just like, what I'm saying is this business makes you crazy.
Yeah,
okay. So we have to be careful.
Yes.
We have to be careful to keep our sanity and keep ourselves grounded and know the important things in life, you know? Yeah.
Well, I mean, and you're talking about the important things of life plus your work. You've done so many different movies. What kind of projects are you working on now? Or what would you like to do if you could pick, or what are you working on now?
Well, honestly, I started The Decline 4, which I can't say what it's about. I know. I can't say what it's about because somebody will go out and shoot it before I'm done. but I started it before I started putting the Decline DVDs out. So I had to put it on hold. And then I went on tour to all the theaters to show The Decline movies. It was on hold longer. Mm-hmm. And now I'm diving back into it. So there's that.
Okay.
And then there's another documentary on my mom. And you know what I should tell you, Chris, is you probably don't know this, but my mom ran away with a carnival when she was 19 years old, and she married the carnival owner that was 40 years old, and he was a wrestler.
Oh, wow.
I know.
He was, that's where it came from, by the way, wrestling. Wrestling came from the carnies.
Did it?
The carnivals, yeah.
Well, my father was one of the early ones.
Wow.
And I know his name was down at the Olympic Auditorium at one point, somebody told me.
What's his name?
Andrew Spheris, yeah. Okay. And he wrestled when he was younger, but then when he got older and when he knew my mom, he had a carnival, and he was the strong man on the carnival. Okay, so he would go around to different towns and, like, you know. My vision of my dad, you know, was him standing there with chains around each of his arms and then attached to bumpers of cars, and the car's wheels are spinning. And they would call that like a free act, which means you watch this and then go pay to go in.
See the real stuff.
You see the real thing and go over there. But, you know, they have a guy like put oil underneath the tires. You know?
right. So the tires are moving and he's keeping them at bay with the chains
like,
in his
that's
arms.
That's how strong he is.
So you're going to make a documentary about
halfway
him?
Through. That one too.
And,
yeah.
Wow. So when you're doing this sort of stuff now, is it different now in 2017 to get financing than it was in 87, for example?
Well, thanks to Wayne's World and the other studio pictures I did, and thanks to the fact that digital filmmaking is cheaper, then I could pay for it myself.
Gotcha.
So this is the ultimate freedom, you know? Mm-hmm. And my accountant goes, Penelope, what are you doing with your money? I'm like, well, I'm just making my movies, man, because I got a habit, you know?
Yeah,
I got a
habit.
Real habit.
You
got
to feed the monkey, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you're talking about, so with Wayne's World, you still get good royalties off of that because they show it on TV, for example?
Well, they do. And I mean, yeah, they were Paramount was kind enough to give me a percentage of it. So I still to this day.
Gotcha.
Receive something from that movie, and I thank them for that. You know, I'm very fortunate. And then I don't have as many houses as Johnny Depp does, but I have a few. I put my money into real estate, so that was kind
smart
of
too, right?
a good move. Yeah.
When I was looking at the poster for the 20th anniversary, it says on there also features a I don't know if it's a Q&A or a meeting between the cast members in modern day.
Yeah.
How was that? Who was on the panel?
Well, what happened? There's this guy. His name is Mark Ehrenkranz, and he works with Peter Travers from Rolling Stone magazine. And they put together this half an hour that consists of a panel that I did with Tia Carrere and Robert Patrick, the Terminator cop, and Colleen Camp. And then there was another panel with Mike and Dana and me and Lauren on it, and Rob Lowe. And then Peter Travers makes some comments about Wayne's World. It's a good program.
Was it fun seeing all those guys again?
Yeah, it was really cool.
Under the umbrella of Wayne's World?
I know.
Yeah.
It was awesome, you know? I mean, Mike's just all about, you know, his children now and wanting to stay home and be dad, you know.
He hasn't done a lot in the last few years.
No, I think he's a good dad. He stays at home and he's got three kids now, so.
You guys, is it fun to see him again?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, we're all good. Everything's fine.
You create something classic like that.
Yeah, you got to be just appreciative that the audience loved it so much.
Because
that's
the thing. I mean, how many filmmakers, how many movies have this project, this product that's, like we said earlier, still resonates 25 years later? It's a pretty rare thing.
Yeah. I don't understand it, to be honest with you, Chris. I really don't get it. I just feel very blessed that it happened and that people are still interested in it and care about it. I think I probably, you know, if there's a God, it was just that God felt really bad for giving me a really crappy childhood, so he wanted to make up for it and put me with all these really fun people to work with and have the movies come back 25 years later, you know?
Yeah. Final question, it's a two-parter, and I know you haven't seen a lot of your movies, but what's your favorite scene from Wayne's World, and what's your favorite scene from Decline Part 2?
Oh, wow. Gee. That's like, what's your favorite?
Yeah.
What's your favorite kid?
Yeah. Who's your favorite child? Is there one that stands out though in your head or in your mind that?
in Wayne's World. I'm not going to say the obvious and go with Bohemian Rhapsody, but one of my other favorite ones. I had to fight hard to get Foxy Lady in there when...
Really?
I did. I totally had to fight. Because they're like, no, man, Jimi Hendrix ain't funny. I'm like, swear to God, just let him do it.
Oh, yeah. With Dana Carvey, you know,
and
a funeral dirge would be funny.
Talk about
right.
That's what he did was just...
his little ears.
Foxy! Yeah. So that's one of my favorite scenes. And then, of course, the scene with Rob. And the glove,
the rubber glove.
I always laugh at. Yeah. So, but as far as Decline 2, did you say favorite scene?
Yeah.
From
just
Decline?
Curious. What stood out for you?
Oh man, that's a tough one. Ooh, boy. Everybody would say Chris Holmes, but that's just kind of sad. You know. What we always do is quote Nader when he goes, oh no, not more fog.
Yeah, that's great, yeah. On stage, they got the fog machine and there's 50 people on a whiskey on a Tuesday night.
And they had that, what do you call it, like an explosion that happened that like blew the front door off of the...
Really?
Yeah.
So they built their own flash pots, the boom
And
the, pots.
When the boom happened, it blew the front door off of the Roxy or wherever we were shooting. I don't remember. Yeah.
He tries to light the flag on fire and
it won't light.
It won't light.
It's just, like, what else can go wrong?
Like I said,
know?
Anything that could go wrong with those guys, with the London
it
guys
totally
did.
It totally did. I mean, the guy gets handcuffed to a chair and the girl leaves him, you know.
He's got the black eye from the L.A. cop, the angry alley cop.
L.A. cop,
LA
yeah.
L.A. cop, yeah, yeah.
That's funny.
Penelope, it's great talking to you, and we're excited.
You too.
25 years of Wayne's World and Decline 4. We're waiting for it and see what the secret is.
Let's see if I come back for 50, baby. Anyway, y'all party on, huh?
Party on, Penelope.
All right, party on, Chris.
No stairway. Denied.
I've been trying to get to Penelope on the show for a while. She was great. Penelope, as I told her, I thought her name was. So glad it finally worked out, not only to talk about Decline of the Western Civilization Part 2, also to talk about Wayne's World 25. I want to have her back to talk about her upcoming Decline 4. What's she going to be doing that movie about? She won't tell us. I'm sure we're going to find out very quickly, but thanks to her. Thanks for her sharing all the great stories and memories, and happy 25th birthday to Wayne's World.
Shang-Wing.
And like I promised, 10 lucky Talk is Jericho listeners are going to win a digital download copy of the 25th anniversary edition of Wayne's World. All you got to do is tweet party on to @TalkIsJericho and use the hashtag Wayne's World 25. I'll choose 10 lucky winners from everyone who tweets. So that's party on @TalkIsJericho on the Twitter and use the hashtag Wayne's World 25. That's number 25. If you do this, I will choose 10 winners and you'll get a free digital download of the Wayne's World 25th anniversary movie. Okay. And of course, big thanks to you for supporting this show and supporting all my great sponsors. I couldn't do this without you or without them, and that includes Amazon, the OG sponsor. Easiest way to help out the show, use my Amazon links wherever you do online shopping. You can find my Amazon links at podcastone.com. Click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. I got the Amazon links for the USA, the UK, the Canada, and every time you use Talk is Jericho Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to this show to help us cover production costs. No hidden fees or extra charges. Whatever you buy, just go to Amazon through my links, and you will be the coolest guy in town. That's true. Just go to podcastone.com. Once again, click on the Killer Deals button in the right top corner of the page. Then hit Talk is Jericho, and I'll take you to all my great sponsors, including ddpyoga.com/Jericho. 25% off all DDPY merch. And when you buy a max pack or a combo pack, you get a second one for 50% off. The price is already 25% off. What a deal. What a bargain for you. And of course, Blue Apron, cheap, tasty, quick meals, and you'll get your first three meals for free with free shipping at blueapron.com/Jericho. You got to check this out. There's some tasty treats, all right? And don't forget, speaking of tasty treats, March 15th, less than a month away, the biggest podcast ever, because Mick Foley joins Talk is Jericho. We've been talking about this for almost a whole year, and now there's only 26 days left and counting. And don't forget all the great shows on the Jericho Network, okay? So many good ones, of course, Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus, Keeping It 100 with Conan, Beyond the Darkness, Freaking Out 5 days a week, Team Tiger Awesome, they discussed this week how to have sex with a superhero, don't forget that, and... The Jericho Network is growing because we're launching a brand new podcast on Monday, February 27th. Any guesses who's coming to the Jericho Network? I'll give you a couple hints. He has been a guest on this very podcast. He once DDT'd a longtime Talk Is Jericho sponsor on MTV Live. I think that probably gave it away. But go ahead and hit me up on the Twitter at Talk Is Jericho with your best guess. Who is going to be show number 5 on the Jericho Network? You're going to find out Monday, February 27th, the big debut. So thank you so much for listening. Keep listening to the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next and coming up Friday. Doing their first podcast ever. It's Handsome Rusev and Lana. That's right. What more could you want? The first podcast ever, Rusev and Lana, one of the most popular top acts in the WWE, making their podcast debut right here on Talk Is Jericho. You're going to love it, man. More information than they ever wanted to know about them and about the Wendy's fast food chain. Okay, we got all that coming up on Friday. In the meantime and in between time, stay cool, stay hard, stay hungry, and a big yeah, boy. See you on Friday.
Good night and party on.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth.
It's Wayne's World.
Wayne's World. Wayne's World. Party on. Excellent.
And we're out.
Excuse me? Baking soda?
Oh, yeah.
You can download new episodes of Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
But what I'd really like to do is something extraordinary. Something big. Something mega. Something copious. Something capacious. Something kajunga. But I'll probably end up working at Great America, mopping up Hurl and lung butter. Chuh.